The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Good morning. The case set before the court this morning is Barbara Hermanek Peck versus Richard Spy and Susan Spry. Justice Salter is not with us in the courtroom this morning. He's unable to join us, but he is listening by live stream, and he will participate in the decision in this case. With that said, we have Jeff Brekovitz, who's appearing on behalf of the defendants, the Sprys, and Reese Allman, who will be arguing on behalf of the plaintiffs, Barbara Hermanek Peck. Each side will have 20 minutes. Since we don't have an appellate and an appellee, there'll be no reply argument. So with that, Mr. Brekovitz, you may proceed with your argument. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, my name is Jeff Rutkevich. I am one of the attorneys for the defendants, Richard and Susan Spry. The case involves a deceased man named Richard Hermanek. He died on March 14 of 2019. To make it clear, the defendants deny the allegations in the underlying lawsuit. So in the course of discussing the various issues, I just want to make that clear. It's always an honor and a privilege to appear before this court, but in this case, I'll admit it's also somewhat of a frustrating honor because, in the view of the defendants, the two causes of action, they really didn't need to be asserted. They don't add anything new or different. In the underlying lawsuit, there were four counts or claims, the first for breach of fiduciary duty, the second for conversion. And then the two statutes were referenced that are within the certified questions to this court, Chapter 2165, and then also SDCL 2246.13. There is nothing different or new or additional that's available under those two statutes that isn't already available in a claim for conversion or breach of fiduciary duty. Both sides in their briefs cite legal authority for the basic proposition that the court has to construe statutory language in a way that it doesn't lead to an absurdity or an illogical or unreasonable outcome. And ironically, or I guess, expectedly, both sides argue that the opposing interpretation is absurd and illogical. And ultimately, the court has to make sense of all this. The questions that were certified by Judge Pearsall, the first question, second and third, they all have their origin in South Dakota Legislature Senate Bill 168, which was passed during the 2015 legislative session. And through that legislation, a task force was created to look into issues of elder abuse. And that task force, in December of 2015, issued a final report and recommendations. And it was that report and recommendations that resulted in the enactment of Chapter 2165 and SDCL 2246.13. And former Justice Zinter was actually part of that task force. The task force was looking for new ways to provide additional protections to senior citizens and vulnerable adults. There was already a claim or cause of action for conversion and for breach of fiduciary duty at that time. So that nature of relief and those causes of action, the legislature didn't need to duplicate that. The task force didn't need to recreate the wheel. They needed to create something new. So through Chapter 2165, they created what's effectively a protection order proceeding to protect vulnerable adults. And it's really modeled substantively after domestic abuse protection orders and stalking and harassment protection orders. If you look through those statutes and the language, There's nothing that expressly says you can't get a protection order against someone who's deceased, or a deceased person can't get a protection order. But there's also nothing saying that domestic turkeys can't fly. They have wings, but they don't fly. Sometimes logic is necessary, if not indispensable, to the interpretation and application of any statute. And looking at Chapter 2165, it creates a cause of action allowing for limited and immediate relief. We sit here today with a case where the individual in question, Mr. Hermanic, passed away 2 years and 10 months ago. There is no sense of immediacy or urgency. I don't believe that our task force said, let's create a cause of action that lets someone seek a protection order 2 years and 10 months after they're dead. That would be an absurdity.
Well, and isn't that really the question that Judge Pearsall phrased to this court and presented to this court is there a cause of action against the decedent? Isn't that really what we need to consider in this case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that the court can answer that question, the first question. Does South Dakota recognize a private right of action for a violation of Chapter 2165 after the death of the vulnerable adult? No. And the answer is why? Because it's logically and legally impossible, and it's procedurally unworkable when you look at the statutory language. The language itself talks about the vulnerable adult in the present tense with the assumption or presumption that he or she is alive. But it also provides a right to notice and participation. So when a substitute petitioner, which would be the case here, files a petition for protection, the vulnerable adult retains certain rights to contact and retain counsel, access records, to object to the protection order. None of those things can be accomplished or carried out in a situation where the vulnerable adult is no longer living. So from a due process standpoint, it's not difficult, it's practically impossible. It would almost be like a game of make-believe to go through this process. But beyond that, too, there's also a requirement for a hearing. And if the petition provides sufficient grounds for relief, the court has to order a hearing. And that hearing has to take place within 30 days. There's been no hearing here, nor would there need to be one, because there's no active need for protection. There's also notice requirements as it involves the party or persons to be restrained. They have a right to be served. Venue is also a very important consideration because it presumes that the petitioner is living. And when they talk about venue under the statute for 2165, it makes it clear that the venue is where the vulnerable adult resides or where the target resides. A deceased person, not to be crass, they don't have a residence. They don't have a presence. I think that the first issue is fairly straightforward and simple to answer. But I will admit, though, that 2165, in our view, in many ways, was meant to relate to and complement the next statute that we'll focus on, which is 2246.13.
Counsel, just, you know, your points aside with regard to whether this is needed or whether it makes sense to proceed in this type of an action, the protection order proceeding allows for a finding of a vulnerable adult needing protection if there's both either abuse or financial exploitation. So, and obviously your point is well taken, certainly with regard to the abuse component of that no longer exists after a person is deceased. But can you explain how your arguments relate to the other part of a a potential proceeding initiated for financial exploitation and whether that could still be an ongoing concern even after the person is deceased.
The limit, the relief that's provided under the protection order provisions under the Chapter 2165, it is limited in nature. And the language in the statutes provide that there are certain things that the court can't order or can't provide. It's more or less a safety net. Let's put things on pause. Let's preserve the status quo and then allow for other proceedings to play out that are more appropriate, more detailed. But it's an interesting question you raise about that finding of financial exploitation. Because in 2165, there is a definitional section, and as part of those definitions, under 2165.1, subpart 7, they define financial exploitation. And its exploitation is defined in subsection 2246.1 when committed by a person who stands in a position of trust or confidence. So we have a definition here that does specifically refer to 2246.1, which does carry us into the issues 2 and 3. And initially, our argument and our primary position is that this court should construe for 2165, hold that there is no private cause of action after a vulnerable adult has died. And it's more or less a notion of abatement. But for the next question, the civil claim under 2246.13, our primary position is that a conviction for theft should be required, and that or only refers to a definition that's part of the criminal statute. That's our primary position. But there's a different way that this court could approach this on that second issue in looking at 2246.13. And it's tied also, it's an issue that the court needs to consider mindful of the notion of due process, because the relief under 2246, it allows for disinheritance. It operates like a slayer statute. And that's a severe penalty. I mean, that's more than money damages. That's a big deal. It is. And in those circumstances, we worry that recognizing just a blank or naked cause of action that would allow for an entry of a finding in a default scenario that has such significant consequences could raise some serious due process concerns. But if you look at 2246.13, it's clear that it says a court may find that an elder or adult with a disability has been exploited as defined in 2246.1 or 2246.3. And then once that finding occurs, a cause of action is created. Now, 2246.3 is the criminal statute. So in the course of a conviction under that statute, a finding with exploitation would be inherent as part of the indictment or charge. But there's also a reference to 2246.1. And the statute's clear, a finding has to happen. Where can that finding happen? The only other place that specific finding is provided or required is in the protection order proceeding. So a court in the course of a protection order proceeding could make a finding of financial exploitation with a living individual that would provide them with the civil cause of action and these additional forms of relief. And the reason that finding can happen, it can happen in a criminal case because you've got that defendant there. You have a captive audience for due process purposes. And honestly, I believe the finding of exploitation could occur in any criminal case during the sentencing and restitution phase, consistent with due process. Because a lot of times, I mean, here's the thing is, it's wrong to defraud anyone of money, even if they're 30 years old in perfect health and smarter than Einstein. It's wrong. Very often, prosecution might decide to charge it out in the alternative. They can charge the elder abuse statute. They can charge standard exploitation because a jury could find, well, they're not vulnerable. yeah, well, they were still a victim. They were still defrauded. It's still a crime then. So there's a chance for pleading in the alternative there or charging it out. But the finding can occur in the criminal context because they're captive, due process. It can occur in the protection order case because the defendant has to be served. No protection order will be entered on a continuous lasting basis. And as a practical matter, you can't protect someone or restrain someone who's absconded or is not able to be located. So the due process considerations there, a court can make that finding of exploitation and provide for that measure of relief without having to worry that due process hasn't been satisfied. But the thing is, the relief under 2246, that chapter, and 2165, they both require that the defendant be alive. In the criminal context, abatement applies there as well. And in the protection order context, the same thing. And, you know, superficially that seems unfair. Well, no, because you have conversion and breach of fiduciary duty that provide the same relief. The task force wanted to create something more than conversion and breach of fiduciary duty. They wanted vulnerable adults and elderly South Dakotans who are victims to have redress and relief while they're alive. That was the gap in the law. That was the deficiency. How do we protect them immediately now? Not how do we create a cause of action for a personal representative who maybe met the deceased person a few times while they were alive, 2 years and 10 months after they're dead?
Well, counsel, you're really talking about what was intended here. So we start with the language of the statute. So when I look at 2246.13, it says a court may find an adult or elder person has been exploited. If a court finds that exploitation has occurred, then you get into the remedies. There's nothing in there that limits that to a protection order proceeding under the other statute or a criminal determination. I mean, the statute just says if a court finds. It doesn't say which court. It doesn't say a criminal court. It doesn't say a criminal conviction. It doesn't say in a protection order proceeding. It just says if a court makes this finding that exploitation occurred, past tense. So regardless of what we might argue or think that they intended, don't we look at just the plain language, and doesn't that settle the issue?
You can look at the plain language and apply it as written, and you'll result in the same place, we believe. And that's because the language on its face says that the finding has to be made for the cause of action to arise. And if that means what it says, that means that at the time of this man's death, there was no cause of action. And we have by statute, our survival statute, that allows causes of action for and against a person survives their death. There was no cause of action here because at the time of his death, no finding had been made. And that's a rigid application and interpretation that really leads to the same outcome. And the conclusion is that the statutes don't provide a remedy in a situation where the victim or the petitioner or the vulnerable adult is deceased. And that's really, in looking at the task force report, which could be judicially noticed, I suppose, on some level, but looking at the legislative changes that year, the purpose was and the goal was to create something new and different, not to duplicate a conversion or breach of fiduciary duty claim, which we feel effectively is, you know, the dog pile mentality of litigating to bring as many claims and to label it as many different ways as possible just to kind of create this, you know, oppressing specter of we have all these claims against you. I think that a reasonable interpretation is just more or less practical, that the protection order provisions, they don't apply when you have a deceased vulnerable adult or a deceased defendant. That's not the time and place for that kind of relief. And that as far as the private cause of action under 2246.13, and because of the fact that a finding results in disinheritance, and that's a significant penalty. And even with the application of the Slayer statutes, there's case law talking about the constitutional and due process implications of applying Slayer statutes. That's exactly what this is, and it's exactly, too, the same considerations have to be taken into account and apply. It would not be, I think, a prudent use of time and resources to interpret the statute in a way that really is practically impossible to work or use anyway. In our view, Your Honor, the certified questions could all be answered in the negative, and in doing so, no justice has been deprived or denied to anyone in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Allen, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I want to start off this morning about talking about context. Because anytime we're talking about statutory interpretation, I think context is important. What was the context in which these statutes were enacted? The statutes at issue today, chapter 21-65, as well as 22-46-13 through -18, were all enacted in 2016, actually, not 2015, following this South Dakota Elder Abuse Task Force final report. So that report, which was cited to in the Spry's reply brief, identified two problems that existed. One, the prevalence of elder abuse, and despite that prevalence, the lack of criminal prosecution of elder abuse. Indeed, the report recognizes that there are only 8 charges of theft by exploitation in the preceding 10 years. So despite having a criminal statute that penalizes theft by exploitation, it was not being utilized, even though there was a prevalence of elder abuse. So in response to that report, the legislature created new tools. I agree with counsel when he said it created something new and different. It created new tools to go after elder abuse, to punish elder abuse, and to deter elder abuse. And it did that when it enacted Chapter 21-65, as well as the private cause of action that exists in 22-46-13. So again, the problem was that elder abuse is occurring, and despite it occurring, there's a lack of criminal prosecution. So it's that context that I want you to keep in mind as we turn to the specific certified questions. And I actually want to start in reverse. I want to start with questions 2 and 3, which are really the two sides of the same coin. And the ultimate issue is whether or not a criminal conviction is required to pursue a civil claim under 22-46-13. The answer to that is no, a criminal conviction is not required. And that's a matter of statutory interpretation. When interpreting statutes, you first look to the words of the statute itself. You then look to other statutes relating to the same subject. And finally, once you think you've got that interpretation, you ask, does it lead to a reasonable result? Or does it lead to an unreasonable or absurd result? So let's start with the words of the statute, 22-46-13. Nowhere in that statute are the words conviction, prosecution, found guilty of, a violation of. The word criminal isn't even in that statute. And as this court recognized in the Trum case, words excluded from a statute are presumed to be excluded for a reason. So the legislature, choosing to exclude words like conviction, prosecution, found guilty of, or even the word criminal, shows that the legislature did not intend for a criminal conviction to be a prerequisite to the civil claim. And we know that the legislature can use those words because it has in other statutes. If the court looks at SDCL 40-38-5, which relates to the protection of animal facilities, 22-13-18, which relates to breach of peace, 22-14A-26, which relates to explosive devices, and all of those statutes, the legislature made clear that the civil remedies were dependent upon a finding of guilt in a criminal proceeding. That language doesn't exist in 2246-13. The only scent of criminality that 2246-13 has is its reference to the criminal statute 2246-3. But the statute is clear. The language of the statute is clear. It is referring to that statute for definitional purposes only. A court may find that an elder has been exploited as defined in 2246-1 or 2246-3.
So in what setting should this finding occur? If it's not going to be in a criminal conviction, if it's not going to, if is it going to be made before or after the cause of action occurs?
It can be found in any proceeding. In a probate proceeding, for example, there could be a factual finding that exploitation occurred. In a proceeding under 21-65, for example, a protection order proceeding, it could be found. In a trust proceeding, when you're dealing with a trustee of an elder, there could be a finding there. In a criminal proceeding, certainly the finding could exist if it's specific to a 2246-3 violation. Or in a civil proceeding, which is what we find ourselves in here. The finding can occur in any proceeding. And once that, if that finding is occurs, you're then entitled to compensatory and punitive damages, as well as attorney's fees. 2246-13 also entitles the claimant, either the elder or even the personal representative of the estate of the deceased elder, which is what we have here, they're entitled to attorney's fees. So actually the language of that statute, going back to the language of the statute, that it allows attorney's fees shows that the legislature was actually incentivizing and encouraging this type of claim, this type of civil claim. Not trying to limit it to a very narrow circumstance after a criminal conviction. The fact that it was awarding attorney's fees shows that the legislature was incentivizing this type of claim, a civil claim. Again, looking at the language, it recognizes that a civil claim under dash 13 can be brought if exploitation occurs under either dash 1 or dash 3 of 2246. The definitions are different in those two statutes. 2246-3, in order to bring a criminal charge, requires a special relationship with the elder, some sort of position of caretaking or trust or supervision. Whereas dash 1, the definition of exploitation, anyone can commit. There doesn't need to be that special relationship. So a scam caller, for example, can't be prosecuted criminally under 22-46-3, but they can be charged civilly under 2246-1. Because they satisfy that definition, they don't satisfy the criminal definition under dash 3. And that's important, because that recognizes the legislature noted that there were both a criminal component and a civil component. If you met either definition, you have a civil claim under dash 13. And in his argument today, counsel, as well as in his brief, added language to that statute. If there's a finding, a cause of action arises, or a cause of action is created. The word arises, created, accrues, appears nowhere in 2246-13. It simply says once a finding occurs, you get damages. No different than a breach of contract claim. If there's got to be a finding of an enforceable contract before you can find a breach. Or in a negligence claim, there's got to be a finding that a duty exists before there can be a breach. No different here. There needs to be a finding of exploitation before you're entitled to damages.
So let's assume you're correct on the way you read 2246-13, that it really creates this additional cause of action and you can obtain actual damages, punitive damages, attorney's fees. If that's the case, what additional remedies or what else do you get out of the protection order statute at this point from a practical standpoint?
So the difference between the protection order statute is what it's been referred to as, though I think it's broader than that, chapter 21-65, and the civil claim in 2246-13. 2165 is limited, again, to that special relationship. It creates a civil claim for only the special relationship in the way it defines financial exploitation. So actually, the civil claim in 2246-13 is broader. It applies to more defendants than 21-65. Here, they apply equally.
Yeah, so that's my point, is if you're right about that's what 13 is, what other remedies are available under 2165 that aren't available under the 13 statute?
The
posture you're at right now where you've got the vulnerable adult that's deceased.
In this particular situation, I think the remedies are duplicative of those two statutes.
The remedies are what?
Duplicative.
Of dash 13 as well as the remedies available in 21-65.
And so when would you ever have, when you have a deceased individual, a vulnerable adult that's now deceased, when would you ever have an additional remedy under 2165 that you don't have under the 13 statute, if your interpretation of that statute is correct?
Well, the fact that there are duplicative remedies, the plaintiff can pick which claims they want to pursue. They might decide they only want to pursue claims under 21-65 for whatever reason.
But two statutory schemes cross-reference each other, though. You could make those same claims under a 2246 claim as you can under 2165, can't you?
Yes, you can.
It refers to...
You absolutely can. But just because the relief available, that you can get the same relief from two different causes of action, doesn't necessarily mean one cause of action doesn't exist. You look at the statutory language, other enactments relating to the same, and ask, does it lead to a reasonable result? And I'll get into the cause of action in 2165, but I think it clearly shows that a party can come to court and ask for monetary relief and get its attorney's fees while in the process. And that's the relief the estate's seeking here. It's coming to court, it's asking for monetary relief, and it's going to ask for its attorney's fees. It can get that relief under both avenues. It can. But that doesn't mean that one cause of action doesn't exist.
So can you respond to your opponent's arguments as to why logically and the big picture of protection orders, which are meant to get more at an immediate protection or the stopping of harm and the procedural requirements that go along with that, how it makes sense for those to still apply where you have a deceased vulnerable adult and in the big scheme where you have another remedy under another set of statutes?
Well, again, we're constrained by the language that the legislature used. And the language that the legislature used in 21-65-12 recognizes that you can come into court and the court can order any relief it deems necessary to remedy the financial exploitation. So that's more than just a protection order. That recognizes that it can order any relief necessary to remedy the financial exploitation, including, and then it goes on to explicitly state four different subparts, most of which relate to transferring money from the wrongdoer back to the victim. So 2165, I think, is kind of a misnomer to say it's just a protection order statute or scheme, because it recognizes that it goes beyond protection orders. Any remedy necessary to, or any relief necessary to remedy the exploitation. Surely, what we have here, the estate coming into court and asking that the estate be made whole following that financial exploitation is a relief that would remedy the financial exploitation. So under the plain language of the statute, the estate can come in under Chapter 21-65 or under 22-46-13 and ask for the same relief under both schemes, under both claims. And that's what we've done here.
Do you find any significance in the fact that when we're reviewing both of these chapters in their totality, 2246 specifically references, and particularly in 2246-13, a personal representative and the person who has been exploited estate where we have no specific mention of that in the 2165 statutes?
Yeah, so the 2165 statute is even broader in terms of who can bring it. It says any substitute petitioner, which it defines as any person with an interest in it. And as this court has previously decided in the Marvin Schwann Charitable Trust case, when the legislature uses that broad language, that's what it intends to do. Anyone who has an interest. Here, certainly the personal representative of the estate has an interest in that financial exploitation. So we can bring the claim. Turning back to questions 2 and 3 again, whether or not a criminal conviction is required. I've already talked about what the language of the statute says, so let's look at what other statutes relating to the same subject say. And I want to look specifically at 22-46-18, which says the remedies in 2246-13-17 are in addition to and cumulative with other legal remedies. In other words, the civil remedies in 13 are in addition to and cumulative with the criminal remedy that is in 3. And courts all across the country have recognized when that in addition to language exists, and we've cited to several cases throughout the United States in our brief, they've recognized when that language exists in a statutory scheme, a criminal conviction is not required to pursue the civil claim. So we've looked at the language of that statute. We've looked at another statute relating to the same subject. Finally, we've got to ask, does the interpretation lead to a reasonable result? And that's where the context matters that I talked about at the beginning of this. The legislature was presented with a problem with a high prevalence of elder abuse and a lack of criminal prosecution. Now, the Spry's interpretation that a criminal conviction is required before you can bring a civil claim doesn't solve that problem. The problem is a lack of criminal prosecution. Why would the legislature's solution to that problem depend on the very problem that it's trying to fix? It's trying to fix the lack of criminal prosecution. So the Spry's interpretation, I submit, is unreasonable and leads to an absurd result. And further, why would you handcuff the victims of elder abuse to be at the mercy of the state? Oftentimes the state might choose not to prosecute criminally, particularly like here, when the primary victim has passed away. Right? That's probably gonna be the best evidence would be the testimony of the decedent in terms of the abuse. The state might decide not to pursue criminal charges, but does that mean that the estate or the wrongdoer gets a get out of jail free card? I don't think so. That would be an absurd result. The estate's interpretation, on the other hand, that a criminal conviction is not required to pursue a civil cause of action, leads to a reasonable result. It actually advances the legislature's goal of punishing and deterring elder abuse. Therefore, we ask that the court find that criminal conviction is not required to pursue a civil claim. Jumping to question one now, chapter 21-65, does that right of action survive the death of the vulnerable adult? And counsel today acknowledged that statute does create a cause of action. Their brief said it didn't. Today they acknowledged it does create a cause of action. And I think that's pretty clear from the language of the statute. So if you look at 21-65-2 as well as 12, if you read them together, it recognizes that a private party can come into court and request monetary relief. And in fact, 21-65-15 also allows that party attorney's fees. So again, the legislature incentivizing, encouraging people to use this cause of action.
Counsel, what do you make of 21-65-1 subprint 15, which defines a vulnerable adult as someone who is, using the present tense, unable to protect himself or herself from abuse?
Yeah, for the claim to accrue, certainly there has to be a living vulnerable adult. To abuse a vulnerable adult, there has to be a living vulnerable adult. But that just means that's when the claim exists, when the abuse occurs. Just because that adult then dies doesn't mean that claim dies. And in fact, we go back to the rules of statutory interpretation. We have to look to the words of the statute. Nowhere in Chapter 21-65, nowhere does it say that this new claim that we just created dies or ceases to exist or becomes void upon the death of the vulnerable adult. And again, every word excluded from a statute must be presumed to be excluded for a reason.
So under 2165, who does the personal representative represent? The deceased vulnerable adult or the estate of the deceased vulnerable adult?
I think the estate actually can fill two shoes. It can be a substitute petitioner under the definition of substitute petitioner, and it can also be the actual vulnerable adult under the definition of vulnerable adult if you apply SDCL 29A-3-703, which recognizes the PR stands in the shoes of the decedent for any claims that the decedent would have had. So I actually think the estate falls under both the definition of the vulnerable adult as well as the substitute petitioner in terms of standing to bring the claim.
Your time's up, Mr. Allman. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and for your briefs in this case. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess.
Terrible swift song, his truth is more.